Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host, and our guest is Stephen Gowans. Stephen has written three very important books. One is Israel, a Beachhead in the Middle East. Also, he has written Patriots, Traitors in Empires, the Story of Korea's Fight for Freedom, and a book to do with the Syria war, Washington's Long War on Syria. These are all published by Baraka Books. We're joined now by Stephen Gowans. How are you doing, Stephen?
I'm doing well, Phil. How are you?
Very good. It's really, as I was saying earlier, you have a new article, and it's at gowans.blog. I urge people to please find that article. Because today's papers tell me that all the big shots in Washington and London are very suddenly all wanting to talk about China. I noticed that today, or Sunday, Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times says that Biden has a special problem. I think he calls it a nightmare with China. And he says the problem will be managing the reckless Xi Jinping, the president of China, managing him. And there's an article in Politico that says that they're going to shift their attention from the Middle East to confront China. This is Political talking. And probably the more, and I don't know if you've seen these articles, but there's one also, the Atlantic Council. I want you later to tell us about who they are. But they've published a really curious one by a someone that they call Anonymous, who is a prominent former, maybe serving, I don't know, State Department figure. And they're creating a parallel with George Kennan, because George Kennan in 1946 advocated containing, was his word. It was a lie in my opinion, but anyhow, containing the Soviet Union. And he published a piece at that time as Anonymous. And it was, became America, they call America's doctrine. So now the Atlantic Council has an Anonymous imitating Kennan. Seems to me you've got, you, Stephen Gowans, you've addressed this with your title is U.S. Media Hide Malignant and Destabilizing U.S. Actions in Plain Sight While Accusing an Official Enemy of the Same. With all that introduction, what's going on here with this malignant destabilizing stuff?
Well, if we listen to the Western press, the malignant destabilizing behavior is behavior of the Chinese government. And recently, in particular, with regard to bomber flights, warplane flights around the Taiwan Strait or into what Taiwan declares as its air defense identification zone. And the U.S. press has complained about this. The United States government has complained about this, which is why the U.S. press complains about it, because they can, can be relied upon to echo any of the concerns of the State Department. And China has been chided by Washington for its aggressive behavior in connection with Taiwan. So that's what we're to believe is the destabilizing and malignant behavior. What the US press puts little emphasis on, I can't say that it ignores it because I know about this as a result of reporting in the US press, but it puts little emphasis on similar behavior. In fact, malignant and truly destabilizing behavior by the United States government. So for example, if you pay a lot of attention to some of the US press, you'll discover that the United States has maintained a continuous bomber presence on the periphery of Chinese airspace for the last 20 years. So, and these are B-52 bombers and other strategic bombers that are incessantly patrolling that airspace and essentially doing what they accuse the Chinese of doing with respect to Taiwan. And recently, the Wall Street Journal had an article about one of these B-52 flights, and it just highlighted what it was like and talked about the air crew violating what the Chinese regard as their airspace, and the U.S. crews replying that they would continue their mission. They were simply not a warplane, but a military aircraft engaged in lawful activities. So one might ask, is the behavior of maintaining a continuous bomber presence on the verges of Chinese airspace for the last 20 years destabilizing and malignant? I think that any unbiased observer would say it was. Now you could ask, well, what about the Chinese behavior of sending bombers into the Taiwanese self-declared airspace zone. But that kind of narrative assumes that Taiwan is a separate country and is separate from China, which is the way in which the US press and the US government and Western governments now like to portray Taiwan as a separate country. But I think we should take cognizance of the fact that Taiwan has never declared independence. Taiwan has always been a part of China. The state that has control over the Taiwanese borders have never said that they're an independent country, that there's an independent country called Taiwan. They've always regarded themselves as part of China as well. And moreover, we can also blame the United States for in essentially intervening in the civil war in China and never allowing it to come to fruition and to be ended. In 1950, June 25th, 1950, which is the conventional start date of the Korean War, President Harry S. Truman sent the 7th Fleet into the Taiwan Straits with the purpose of preventing Mao's forces from crossing the straits to regain or to gain control of Taiwan, which had, after the Second World War, been liberated from the Japanese who had colonized it. In effect, the United States, not in effect, I mean, actually, the United States had intervened directly into the Chinese Civil War. And as a result of that intervention, China remains divided, just as the United States intervened in the Korean War the same time, 1950. And as a result of that intervention, Korea remains divided.
By the way, that could be seen also as one process, right? In other words, they were encircling, attempting to dominate and eventually overthrow the Chinese government, the new Chinese government. I mean, in other words, Taiwan and Korea being one process.
Yes, exactly. Part of exactly the same process. And that process was one of preventing East Asia from falling under the control of the people who lived in East Asia and organized for the benefit of those who lived in East Asia, instead organizing it for the benefit of the United States, and in particular, Wall Street and corporate USA.
We really have it seems to me your article does underline something that we should be reminded of, is just how powerful media is here and causing us to forget, or even forget our own words. And for example, you've just now said that Taiwan is part of China and there is a one China policy, and US and Britain and others entered into some official language recognizing that fact. But you wouldn't know that reading 2021 newspapers, it's as though Taiwan has been there as an independent, but that wasn't the point of view of the of Washington, London some years back.
No, it wasn't. And the United States arrived at an agreement with China on Taiwan, which is that Taiwan would be recognized as part of China. And it undertook certain obligations to reduce arms sales to Taiwan, to refrain from maintaining official relations with Taiwan, and to withdraw the US military. Despite those pledges, the United States has recently spent $250 million to build a de facto embassy in Taiwan. And have dispatched people with cabinet rank to speak with the Taiwanese government, which effectively recognizes Taiwan as being separate from China. And while the United States had pledged to withdraw US military from Taiwan, reportedly US military are being clandestinely reinserted. Mm-hmm. So they backed away from this. And they backed away from this with the intention of being destabilizing and engaging in malign behavior.
Mm-hmm. You go into the how they rationalize this, their conduct, and it seems to be apropos, of course, of now we have the new enlightened professional guys running Washington as opposed to the madman, the theory. And we're hearing from the Biden team that they're going to go about this approach to China in a smarter way. They're going to build an alliance of democracies. At the same time, by the way, as some are underlining, they're actually in this new concept of democracies confronting authoritarian China, they're a little more belligerent, actually. I mean, they're moving into a situation which your article highlights, which is a kind of, we're in a theater of potential combat, the way they go about this. But at any rate, they advertise this as it's going to be an alliance of democracies. And of course, it's sort of a righteous campaign. Can you talk about this idea of American virtue and doing the good things? Or always good?
Yeah. Always good. Yeah, and that's part of the doctrine that.
There's a woman, Marilyn.
I mean, I've been spelled out. That's right. And she was talking about the doctrine that actually Eric Kennan had a hand in articulating. And the doctrine essentially is that once you accept it, is that the United States, all of US actions are by definition admirable and defensible and always undertaken with the very best of intentions, because the United States is the shining light on the hill and the beacon to the world, and therefore must have a leadership position in the world. The doctrine also holds that all actions by US enemies are by definition unadmirable, malignant, and destabilizing, because they're the action.
Even when they appear good, right?
Yes, even if they appear good, that's simply
conquering COVID-19, obviously, is it appears good, but it's actually bad. I have to call attention. You must have seen it. The New York Times article saying, did China do too well in fighting COVID? And you say, where does it like that come from? The bottom of what type of brain? Reptilian brain would say that.
Yes, and they've also, advanced all kinds of completely unconvincing explanations for why it is that China has been able to bring the pandemic to heel and the United States hasn't, attributing you know, the success of the Chinese government to its authoritarianism, losing sight of the fact that there are other governments that they don't call authoritarian that have done just as well, or maybe not as well, but well in curbing the pandemic. I mean, Taiwan, for example, which they celebrate as a robust democracy, has done just as well as China. South Korea has done very well. Australia, New Zealand. So, I mean, you can see that this is part of this systematic program to build a black legend about China, to discredit it, to demonize it, to throw as much dirt on it as possible. And they're simply bending over backwards to do this, encouraging Sinophobia, which is now the acceptable, the acceptable form of kind of a racism. Mm-hmm. Just as Islamophobia became an acceptable form of racism at a certain point when it suited U.S. Strategic considerations.
Yeah, there is this where we get bombarded with negative media, and then about they let a little gap go by, and then they say, goodness, everybody hates Muslims. Goodness, everybody hates Chinese. And you say, well, we have had intensive propaganda saying they're bad. I guess, you know, now that you take the poll, it turns out that your propaganda was working. Talk about how dangerous all this is. In your article, you mentioned that if you follow the pattern of reasoning, and you know, going back to your B-52 pilot, they're talking in a way that would indicate the danger of, if they, for example, beginning an argument over Taiwan, this could become a question of who controls the South China Seas. Notice the name China, South China Seas, and then also to the Pacific Ocean. That's a rather menacing thought.
Yeah, and I was kind of astonished, you know, in this article that I wrote, I made reference to this particular article in the Wall Street Journal, which astonished me because it very blithely talked about U.S. wars of the future. And it was about how the B-52 would be one of the principal instruments used in the U.S. wars of the future. And I thought that was incredible that one could simply talk about wars of the future as if they were inevitable, already planned and already on the agenda. But I remembered that the RAND Corporation, so, which is a think tank which advises the U.S. military, it's funded by the U.S. government and corporations and usually the defense industry. In 2016, they wrote a report that was titled War on China, Thinking Through the Unthinkable. And I took a look at the report. I'd read it in 2016. I revisited it today. And what struck me about it was, while the report did say war with China would probably, well, is not a war that the United States would win, this is what it acknowledged, at the same time that China would come off, would be affected much more negatively than the United States would. And it pointed out that such a war would probably be limited to East Asia, because the Chinese do not have the means to project military power to continental North America. So it would be limited to East Asia, that this would devastate the Chinese economy, and that it would set back Chinese economic development by decades. And one, I mean, that's a goal of US foreign policy, is to set back Chinese economic development. Now, whether you achieve that through military means or through other means, I suppose, is a decision that's being made at the Pentagon and the White House and the State Department. But that suggests that war perhaps might be regarded as a way of dealing with the economic challenge that that China poses to the United States. But even the idea of thinking the unthinkable and thinking that a war with China is something that needs to be planned for, needs to be put on the agenda, needs to be considered. And then you can write about it in the Wall Street Journal and talk about it in these fairly neutral terms. Well, in the upcoming wars with China, you know, we're going to rely on the B-52.
Yes, this is very much 1950s kind of talk. We used to have American, again, Air Force generals with their chewing on cigars talking about how they could flatten countries. And they use that sort of the Dr. Strangelove language, the officer who says, well, we may get a haircut here, but we'll be, you know, we'll come out of it. I noticed that the Atlantic Council article, it has a scary idea built into it. And this seems to me is what classic imperialist thought is that they say China's afraid of a war. And mm-hmm. one wants to say to the man who said it, aren't you afraid of the war? Do you have a brain? Do you have, you know, but I wonder about that, if you could speak to it. They're using the words democracy, you know, the alliance of the democracies, but the article in the Atlantic Council piece, and then there was it is in the Atlantic Council piece where he says, the author says, we're now with U.S. power, a decline in U.S. power, quote, would degrade the American soul, including the innate understanding of who Americans are as a people and what the nation stands for in the world. And I want to couple that with the quote from the Labor Party MP, who said happy 180th anniversary to Hong Kong, and we support your struggle for freedom. Actually, what they're saying, I'm asking you rhetorically, but they are saying, are they not, that imperialism is our soul. Conquest is who we are.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what I was thinking. When you're saying that is what defines us, dominating the world is what defines us. Being the self-declared leader of the world, imposing our leadership on the world over the objections of those people who don't want to be led. That's what's going to define. Even at some point, I think it was in a Trump one of the more recent either strategic documents or military documents of the United States defined what is one of the defining features of the United States is free markets and free enterprise. And there's a connection between imperialism and dominating the rest of the world and free enterprise and free markets. When they say this is part of the character of the United States people, they're not talking about the US people, they're talking about a very small part of the US citizenry, that part which has economic interests or investments overseas and is looking for profit-making opportunities overseas. That might be a characteristic of that small part of the US population, but I don't think it's a feature or characteristic of the US population as a whole.
It seems to me, Stephen, in your writings, I'll remind people, by the way, Stephen has three really important books published by Baraka, The Long War Against Syria, I think it's the most recent. We need to remind folks, as you do in your writing, this has to do ultimately with freedom in the Western capitalist world as being the concept being and the idea of democracy, all being dependent upon free enterprise and capitalism. And therefore China and Cuba and Venezuela and Syria, Iran, they've refused to join up with, what's this expression they use? Is it liberal society? I forget the term, but the liberal
The liberal order.
Liberal order. I like the word order attached to liberal. The liberal order. Anyway, but we need to, that, at the foundation of this is, it's capitalism or death with them.
Yes, and it's U.S. capitalism. It's interesting when they do talk about the global liberal economic order, they always say that is U.S. statespeople. We defined it. We established it. And it benefits us considerably. It's the basis of our prosperity. And therefore, it must continue to reign, and no one can challenge it. Because if you do challenge it, then you challenge our prosperity and our investment interests and our profit-making interests. And so they worry that China, Beijing is challenging that model, challenging our prosperity. And there are a number of US politicians who've said quite plainly that the problem with China is not that it's an aggressive military power, that's a complete fabrication. The problem is that they're challenging our prosperity because they're competing against us effectively, or it looks like they might dominate the industries of the future, like artificial intelligence and robotics. And all of these things are essential to US military supremacy. And if we lose our technological supremacy, we'll lose our military supremacy. And if we lose our military supremacy, we won't be able to impose our economic interests on other countries.
Oh, it's rather close to the Dr. Strangelove again. We'll lose our essence, our democratic essence. I'm sure you've seen the film.
Yes.
And so much of the language is caught up in this. Talk about this alliance. I'm interested in the how confident they are that they can line up countries like Japan and India. And it is noticeable, I have to say, India played along with the US. They had a border fight, not just recently, but 40 years ago with China. That was, I remember John Kenneth Galbraith, the young man from Ontario, actually, who was considered brilliant and all. He was 100% for India in that exchange with China. And the only writer I remember really contradicting this whole idea that China was the bad party in the dispute was I.F. Stone. But everybody else thought, okay, India's our friend. How are they so sure of themselves when they begin, like Biden's coming in, and he said, well, you know, we have these people, and the name that comes up is India. Another one is Japan. And of course, Taiwan. They put Taiwan in the group, and you say, well, how did they come to be there? But anyhow, go ahead.
And Australia.
You can always count on them, yes.
Yeah, I mean, trying to recruit these countries is as part of their, the alliance to, as they call it, contain China. There might be some reluctance on the part of some of these countries to become embroiled in any kind of military conflict with China. But in the RAND report that I alluded or referred to previously, I mean, there's some discussion about China becoming involved in any war, any kind of Sino-US war, and they would become involved because the United States has many military bases in China. In fact, Japan. Japan is effectively, a military colony of the United States. I mean, it has, approximately 50,000 US troops throughout the country. And in Okinawa in particular. And so inevitably, the RAND report predicts that those bases would be struck by the Chinese, which would bring the Japanese into the war. But India is also interesting. India is interesting in connection with the charge that the Chinese are engaged in a genocide against the Muslim people in Xinjiang. And that's interesting because if there's one country that's engaged in an effort to oppress Muslims. It's India with its Hindu nationalist government, which has undertaken a number of measures which have been contrary to the interests of Muslims. And when it's pointed out to the United States that you're carrying on this campaign to suggest that China is anti-Muslim, and yet you say nothing about India, your great ally, they acknowledge, well, you know, we're trying to cultivate this friendship with India so that we can use India against China. So if India wants to engage in anti-Muslim behavior, well, that's fine with
us. Expression of democracy. We're speaking to Stephen Gowans, gowans.blog. You know, another worrying thing that your article really underlines, it helps us with, is that all this is, I guess you could say, ethnocentric. The United States is continually talking about international order, the liberal order, but there is an order, and it came about as a result of defeating fascism in World War II. It's called the United Nations. It meets, and their countries are represented. The language of the United Nations they use words like multilateralism. I think it's now considered multilateralism is a subversive expression in Washington.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, because the United States talks incessantly about the necessity of the United States leading the world. I mean, Biden has been talking about that. The United States must lead the world. The United States is back in its leadership position, which means every other country must follow, and that the peoples of the world are not going to live together equally. They're not going to be regarded as equal. There's the subordinate people, which is everyone other than the United States, and all countries must be subordinate to the United States. And if you're not subordinate to the United States, you're declared to be a revisionist power, which is what they call China and what they call Russia and what they call Venezuela. But in particular, Russia and China are revisionist because they're trying to revise the liberal economic order in which the United States is at the apex and everyone else is subordinate to the United States. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, going back to Japan, we could talk about Japan and how the United States reacted to Japan in the 80s. As anticipating what would happen with China today, because Japan at one point was challenging the United States economically, and the United States retaliated, and it retaliated by attributing the Japanese success to their theft of US intellectual property, and because they were underhanded and they were stealing US secrets and they weren't competing fairly. And the United States, because it dominates Japan, dominates it militarily, is occupying Japan militarily, imposed or extracted concessions from Japan, which essentially affected Japan in a very negative way. They're still living with the consequences of that. And exactly the same thing is now happening with China, except the difference is China is not a dependency of the United States. And China can say, no, I mean, we have our interests. Our interests are not going to be subordinate to yours. And we're going to pursue our interests.
And they're a member of the United Nations and on the Security Council.
And they're not interested.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Despite all the efforts to portray China as being an aggressive power, if you look at anything the Chinese government says, you'll see that they're far from aggressive. And when you consider this rationally and from the Chinese perspective, you'll see that there's nothing to be gained for China in being an aggressive power. It's not. It wants to live peacefully within the world and to develop. And that was, you know, the guiding philosophy, the peaceful rise of China, because it knows that like North Korea, which their attempts always to present North Korea as an aggressive power. North Korea is not an aggressive power. It can't be an aggressive power because it's not militarily potent, and what, you know, nuclear weaponry it has is simply purely self-defensive. But China's the same. China isn't picking fights, and because it's not in its interest to pick fights with anyone.
Yeah. Well, I think we have to end it there. But Stephen Gowans, gowans.blog, I urge everybody, please go to the site. Thank you very, very much, Stephen.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.